Good evening. Does anyone have a watch that I could borrow? I just don't want to use my phone. Thank you. Is there anybody here for the first time this evening? Okay, well, welcome back, everyone. I wanted to talk a little about some practical ways that we can remember our true nature, because I think we have a tendency to forget a lot of the time that our true nature is vast, that it's all-inclusive. Nothing is outside of ourselves. But we do forget that a lot. And I was thinking of the three Buddha bodies, the Dharmakaya, Sambhogakaya, and Nimanakaya, and that they are our bodies. They are our bodies, all those three. So the Dharmakaya is the truth body. Boundless, limitless. There's no particularity. There's no exclusion of any sort. That's our boundless, limitless body. And the Sambhogakaya is the bliss body of mutual enjoyment. And this, for me, this is our connectedness, you know. We exist only in relationship to each other. Like only in relationship to each other. That aspect of us being all interconnected, interpenetrating, all the time. And we see that expressed in Sangha. It's very joyful, very expressive. And then Nimanakaya, which is our unique expression. The wateriness of water, the nettiness of netti, this particular expression of Buddha nature, each person's individual expression, that the world would be diminished if anyone left that aspect, you know, that there's no one better than you to be expressing the Dharma, like just no one better than you to express the Dharma. So that's the Nimanakaya. Body. And I think when we see ourselves in these three ways, this sort of boundless, all-inclusive, unique, we can keep those sort of like three words, whichever other words you would like, boundless, interconnected and unique, when we can kind of hold that in our minds, we're a lot less prone to self-criticism. A lot less prone to criticizing others. We're less prone to comparisons and to feelings of alienation. So throughout this talk, and really anywhere, whenever we use the word like I, you, me, them, self, other, when we use those words, even though they sound like they're talking about a specific entity, if we can keep in our minds that that's just a problem of language, and when we say me or you, we are really saying everything, everyone, all the time. We can practice that when we talk about ourselves. I feel this way. Even in a simple way, we can say, I feel this way, as do so many other people. You know, I have this experience, as do millions of others, you know, over vast periods of time, and will also in the future. Even in a simple way like that, whenever we think about ourselves, and even talking about ourselves just in our own mind, or when we talk about another person, that other person's very annoying, I'm that other person as well. I'm very annoying. Just every time you use language that way, use those words, because those words are so seductive. They seduce us into feeling that there's something isolated, but there's not. So even as I'm speaking, whenever, if I'm saying, I have done this, or you might like to try that, we can practice thinking of those words as meaning a very big inclusive I, or a very big inclusive you. And I think the difficulty is that when we are stressed, whether it's a little stress or a very large stress, the tendency at that moment of stress is to contract. We sort of contract our conception of ourselves as soon as we're stressed, which is really unfortunate because that's the exact time when it would be good to be expansive. But we do have a tendency to contract when we're feeling some sort of difficulty. And if you look at difficulty, really, it all, fear is kind of at the base. Fear, which is sort of like aversion, is at the base of these feelings, these negative feelings. And so if we can find practical ways, which is what I'm leading to, practical ways to reduce feelings of fear, then we may have a better chance of remembering our expansiveness more of the time. And there's, in our Friday koan study group, we've been looking at cases from the Mumonkon, and we spent 3 weeks looking at a case 15, Tungshan, 60 blows. And I wanted to talk a little bit about this case because it's a good example of a case that kind of generates a fearfulness in people. In Tungshan, character in the story, there was a lot of anxiety, and for people reading the case, it brings up anxiety. So I want to kind of look at that anxiety, and then how do we work with that in a way that's beneficial for us. Tungshan, 60 blows. Tungshan came to see Yunmen. Yunmen asked him, "Where were you most recently?" Tungshan said, "At Chao Tu." Yunmen said, "Where were you during the summer?" And Tungshan said, "At Pao Su Monastery in Hunan." Yunmen said, "When did you leave there?" And Tungshan said, "August 25th. Yunmen said, "I spare you 60 blows." Next day, Tungshan came again and said, "Yesterday you said you spared me 60 blows. I don't know where I was at fault." Yunmen said, "You rice bag, do you go about in such a way, now west of the river, now south of the lake?" With this, Tungshan had great satori. So it's kind of sometimes difficult to talk about a koan in such a short amount of time. Just briefly, so you have a situation where Yunmen is a great teacher and Tungshan is a very advanced practitioner himself. And Yunmen is, you know, inquiring about him, and his questions are an invitation to a conversation. He's not scrutinizing, he's just inviting a conversation that could become a Dharma conversation. And Tungshan, for whatever reason, at this time, just doesn't quite manage to come forth with anything terribly much other than just answering the questions in a fairly literal sense. And because of that, or as that happens, then Yunmen says, "I spare you 60 blows," which is a little like saying, "I can't even be bothered hitting you. I mean, you know, this is just too uninteresting." So that's kind of harsh. It's kind of harsh, but it's all very purposeful. It's not harsh for no reason. So then, what is interesting in relation to this to what I'm wanting to speak about here is what Tungshan then does with this situation where he feels he has failed in a dialogue and not managed to respond very well. Well, what does he do at that point? So I'll read a little bit of Aitken Roshi's comments here. Zen teachers always want to get acquainted before offering instruction, especially Yunmen, who is remembered for his capacity to fit the teaching to the student. But by way of getting acquainted, Yunmen may also be probing for an expression of realization. Where do you come from really means, in this world of coming and going, where do you stand? After Tungshan's straightforward reply, Yunmen asks, where were you during the summer? Referring to the period of intensive training held at Buddhist centers ever since the monsoon retreats in early India. Again, this seems to be a commonplace question, but you can be sure that Yunmen's eyes are fixed on his new student watching for vital signs. At Paothsu Monastery in Hunan, replies Tungshan. There were many great temples in Hunan, a district renowned for its beautiful scenery. Tungshan may have offered this answer uneasily, no doubt wondering when Yunmen would bring him up short. It is not yet the moment. Yunmen gives him a little more leeway. When did you leave there? August 25th, replies the hapless Tungshan. Surely he knows that now he is in for it, for the great Yunmen would not just go on making small talk. But what other answers are possible? Sure enough, Yunmen lowers the boom. I spare you 60 blows. So that night, Tungshan went to bed feeling miserable. As Yunmen comments, he was spending all night in the ocean of yes and no. Tungshan struggled to the ultimate. Where did I go wrong? Why did the teacher say that he spared me 60 blows? This is a very promising condition. Tungshan was unaware that he was in this promising condition. Though he was in great spiritual distress, he was not sulking and not blaming other people, certainly not blaming the teacher, nor was he punishing himself. He was using his distress by focusing on the question, where was I at fault? Rather than falling into the despair of what a mess I am. So this is like wonderful practice. He's really asking, where did I go wrong? Where was I at fault? But he's not asking it in a way of saying, what's wrong with me? With this idea that me could have something wrong with it. He's just saying, in my practice, in how I'm conducting myself in the world, in how I interacted with Yunmen yesterday, where did I go wrong? It's like it's a really good inquiry, a really genuine question. Where did I go wrong? And of course, on an essential level, none of us have ever done anything wrong, you know. But in terms of how we act in the world, we do act in ways that reinforce the delusion that we are separate. We do act that way. And it's really good for us to notice that we do that and then ask ourselves, what am I doing wrong here? Why am I so irritable? Or why am I wanting to do this thing or do that thing that I know is not good for me? I wonder what is going on. And really ask it that way. Really genuinely ask it that way. So that you have the possibility of finding answers rather than asking it in a rhetorical way, what's wrong with me? Which isn't inviting any sort of answer at all. And in this trust in mind, Mu Xiong, that we're studying in Warming the Hearth. He uses some really beautiful terms, and I don't know if if he found them somewhere else, but I've not quite come across them before. He talks about self-referential delusions, which I really like, self-referential delusions, and selfing. Just inventing ourselves. We just invent ourselves with our delusions. We just invent ourselves. We invent an idea of ourselves. We don't invent anything, but we invent an idea of ourselves. Especially when we are self-critical. You know, I think that's the most powerful way in which we create self-referential delusions, is when we are self-critical of our essence, if you want to call it essence, of our being. And I think what is practical to do is to be quite critical and curious about our actions and our thoughts, but not of our being. So the first, in our sutra book, we call it Song of the Trusting Mind, but another translation is Trust in Mind. And the first line is almost exactly the same in this translation. Here it is: the great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. And in our translation, it is: the great way is not difficult for those who hold to no preferences. And here the commentary says, he adds the words, the great way is not difficult for those who have no addiction to preferences. And when I read that, it just struck me so strongly. Well, actually, it was when I read the commentary, then it really struck me strongly. At first, it didn't, but when I read this commentary, it did. I've added the qualifier addiction to preferences in my translation of this first line to point to a richer and deeper meaning of the poetics of the original phrase. It takes us into an understanding that the real issue is not the mere fact of the preferences themselves. And I want to come back to that point because it's a really important point. So it takes us into an understanding that the real issue is not the mere fact of the preferences themselves. We make hundreds of preferential choices in our daily life, and they are neutral in and of themselves. But when we find ourselves willing to defend those preferential choices at the cost of our deeper experience, we are stepping into the realm of addiction. So that's the line there that I'd like to speak about a little bit more. When we find ourselves willing to defend those preferential choices at the cost of our deeper experience, we are stepping into the realm of addiction. And when I read that, I immediately thought of the many, many times in my own mind where I justify my behavior. I just justify it. Not to anyone in particular. I don't need to justify it to anyone in particular because I don't tell anyone about whatever it is I'm doing. I'm justifying it in my mind. And that justification of what I'm doing is, in doing that, I know that that action is an impediment to my awakening in this lifetime. Whenever I'm doing something where I have to go through a repetitive justification of it in my own mind, I'm making it less likely that I'll wake up in this lifetime. And of course, the only reason to wake up in this lifetime is that it's in the process of doing that we help awaken others, and that's a joyful thing. So I'll just read a little bit more here. In the Pali tradition, the word for happiness is sukha, but when we unpack the word, there is nothing really graspable about it. In a deeper sense of the word, sukha is the absence of dukkha. An absence of stress, of anguish. It is the result not of appropriation, but of letting go. And letting go is letting go of our preferences, or more precisely, letting go of our unconscious addiction to our preferences. So So in talking about what some of these addictive behaviors might be, I want to be really careful that they in and of themselves are of no particular consequence whatsoever. There is nothing essentially good or bad or right or wrong or anything about things like alcohol or caffeine or any of the things I'm going to mention here. It's not them. They're not the issue at all. It's what our mind is doing in relation to them. It's what our mind is doing in taking us away from our experience of reality, reinforcing the illusion that I am a separate thing that can get away from something, and I want to get away from that something, whatever that something is. So some of the more obvious ones that we all know about, and many people, I mean most people here probably are not grappling in a very major way with these, but maybe in a more subtle way with some of these. Probably all of us are in some subtle way dealing with some of these. Alcohol, cigarettes, pot, caffeine, sugar, comfort foods, artificial sweeteners, television, Facebook, radio, newspapers, blogs, sort of random novels that don't have terribly much content in them. There's probably an awful lot more. Shopping too much, acquiring objects. So there's nothing wrong with them really, although they, a lot of these ones through time, it has been kind of shown to commonly be problematic. Some of these things commonly can be problematic, but I can see many ways in which, like some people who have got a very fine palate, for them to not be able to go wine tasting feels like just a terrible shame, you know, because they've got a fine palate, so they can do that and they love that. Or if it's part of the family culture that's joyful to have wine with meals or something like that, then I'm sure that's fine. But for us as practitioners, where we're closely looking at what we're doing and wanting to stay intimate as much of the time as possible with everyone and everything, then some of these things, or maybe, well, some of these things may have the effect of reinforcing this idea that we actually need to get away a little bit. Because a lot of these things, the way we relate to them is we often have thoughts like, life is tough, I deserve a treat, or I need these rewards to keep going. I'm safe now so I can do this thing. I need this thing to cope. You know, those kinds of thoughts. And those thoughts are not really good for us, because if we have this idea that the world is difficult or our day has been, like we can have a hard day, but to have a hard day and then say I need to have a particular reward for having survived that day, then in that type of thinking in that moment is separating us from the day, separating us from the people and the events of the day, and we're wanting to hide somehow or escape somehow. And that's not good for our practice to do that. And as well as those sorts of things, then there's other kinds of habits of mind that I think we can get a little addicted to, because they also serve a sort of purpose of creating barriers which feel safer for us to have them. These are just a few I just thought of. There'd be many, many more, but things like comparing ourselves to others, wanting to be right, thinking we're wrong, well, depends on your personality style, whether you tend to want to be right and think you're right, or think, oh, I'm always wrong, I'm probably wrong, I have no idea what I'm talking about. You know, which way you tend to go. Thinking that we actually know what's going on. And self-doubt is the other side of that, thinking that we know what's going on. And then self-doubt, corrosive self-doubt. So they're all habits too that we can look at and say, how is this serving me? Is this helping me feel intimate with everything and everyone and reminding me of my wide, vast Buddha nature? Or is this particular pattern that I get into where I start to get argumentative or start to compare myself unfavorably to someone or compare myself favorably to someone? What does that do when I start doing those things? And I think, you know, it's shrinking our concept of who we are when we do that. So the image that came to my mind about this, because I think it's really important to be careful not to get dogmatic about what one should or shouldn't do. Dogmas, I think, can be it's too rigid, and everybody's life is unique and everyone's circumstance is different. So there's no absolute right or wrong about any of these things. So the image, and also when we try to, say, give up something that we've been doing for a long time, we kind of like move forward, we give it up for a while, then we have something stressful happen and we slip back and we start doing that thing again. And then we kind of develop resolve again because we notice that it's not making us very happy. So we give it up again and we go for a certain distance and then something happens and we start doing that thing again. So I thought of the image of like when a bird is flying, it's flying up into the open sky, up into the vast empty sky. But to go up, it moves its wings up and down. Like a bird can't just fly up, 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 up. It can't just fly up with its wings. Its wings go up and down. So I was thinking about that. The down is the power, the powerful movement that lifts the bird up. And this is like when we make a mistake. We make a mistake, oh, I did that thing. I did that thing I do that's not good for me, that makes me feel separate to others. That's actually the powerful moment. We do that, we can call it wrong thing. And then we go, oh, okay, I'm going to learn from that one. Yes, I'm going to try, I'm going to learn from that. And then again, oh, we do something. Oh, okay, no, okay, I'm going to try again. Oh, there I go, I did it again. Oh, I'm going to try again. I seem to be getting higher up in the sky. So that was the image I was thinking. You know, that's a gentle way of looking at this process of slowly trying to refine our behavior and refine our thinking and refine the way we interact with each other. If we think of it being like that, like a bird flying, and we're flying up into that vast open sky, but we have our wings have to go up and down. It's not going to be just a straight, clear trajectory. But maybe at certain points in time, we will just sort of float on the currents, you know, and our wings don't have to move at all. And that's very beautiful, you know, we just soaring effortlessly. You know, which I think is doing Zazen, being here in the Zendo, that can be soaring effortlessly in the vast sky. So as well as, so these are all practical ways for us to remember our true nature. That's the idea of what this talk is about. Other practical ways are adding more wholesome things to what we do. And that's fairly straightforward and fairly simple. Eat well, exercise, get enough sleep, come to the Zendo, care about the living space you have, care about the environment around you, care about others. Kind of like that part's kind of easy to grasp. But we don't all do it. We don't all do it. So that, in a similar way, we can practice with adding, eating healthier foods, developing better sleeping habits. and developing better ways in which we use our words with people. We can just keep on gently like that bird flying, just do that. And a few talks ago, Jean mentioned the four great endeavors, and I found them very, it kind of captured my mind, so I'd like to just mention them again because it fits with what I've been talking about. The four great endeavors are preventing unarisen, unwholesome states, which could be, like, put simply, just like avoid temptation. Don't go places where you're likely to end up doing something you don't want to do or saying things you don't want to say. Abandoning arisen, unwholesome states. So that is letting go of things that you've been doing that, you know, like what I've been talking about, maybe giving up some things, just residues probably for people here. There's probably just fine residues. Like I've been giving up artificial sweeteners, and the logic being that I'm trying to get something for nothing, and that doesn't fit with the law of cause and effect. You know, if I want something sweet, then I should just have something sweet. I shouldn't say, I'm going to have something sweet with something that doesn't have any calories, isn't really sweet, so I can get away with it, as if there is no law of cause and effect in action when it comes to artificial sweetener. But there is. I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's carcinogenic. But that was my that tiny little behavior that I was doing was me acting as if the law of cause and effect doesn't function in that one small place. So I've given it up. It might seem very tiny, these things, but they're not tiny, because to awaken in our lifetime is really not that easy, unfortunately, just because we have a lot of erroneous views. So each of these little things is really, it's all part of, you know, soaring up into the sky. And it's just as important as being against war or as being concerned about climate change. These little things are not trivial. They're all part of it. You know, nothing is not part of it. That's the radical belief in cause and effect. Nothing is outside of any of this. Nothing at all. Even, you know, whether you have caffeine or half calf, half decaf, or decaf, or herbal tea, or all of this is part of it. It's all part of it. So then arousing unarisen wholesome states. So you're trying to arouse wholesome states, being around good people, good places, Zendo being one of them. And maintaining arisen wholesome states. So continuing doing what's good. You know this is good for your practice, so you know this is good for your recalling of who you really are. So you just keep doing it. Okay, so I'd like to finish soon with just saying that it is a wonderful feeling to have little or no guilt about yourself. You know, and the more we develop wholesome ways of being and reduce the unwholesome things we do with no fanfare attached to it, it's no big deal, we just do it quietly, gently, just this, like this bird flying, just like that. We won't feel so guilty about our existence, you know. And a lot of people feel a lot of guilt, and it's just incredibly liberating. It's very joyful to not feel much guilt. So I'll finish there. Would anyone like to comment or ask questions? Jean.
The three bodies of Buddha. I also hear occasionally described as one body. How do we reconcile three and one?
Well, I guess it is all just one. Those three It's like that interpenetration, all things are one thing. Right here, here in me, in here in you, this unique expression here holds, exists only because everybody's here to hear the words that are coming out here. It's the only reason this unique expression can exist at all in this moment. That's one piece. Kathy?
I really appreciate whatever process it was that led you to discover the bird line. It sounds like, you know, you were kind of working to try to think of what was an analogy. That's how I heard you talking about it. It's not like that's some idea that you had for a long time that you read somewhere, but you actually really found that.
Yes.
Well, because that's really, really, really helpful for me.
Yeah.
Because it's very real. It's very true to real life. And I think I know myself and a lot of people that I talk with, you know, we always struggle with that. You know, what are you supposed to do with your imperfections and how easy it is to get discouraged and think, well, then therefore I shouldn't even practice. Because obviously it's not helping, you know. But and so anytime there's a teaching that is so visceral and so direct about what it actually is, that the process is actually not about not making mistakes and not about not struggling with addiction or, you know, habits of mind, but it's noticing, ongoing noticing. And not just getting then proud of yourself because, oh good, I noticed 5 times or 20 times. Now I'm done. But, it's ongoing. And that's actually the dynamic power that allows us to at some point go, wow, look, I can see more. There's actually a big world out here. But it's this effort, you know. But it's not an effort like a struggle. I mean, that's what the bird does. That's what flying is, you know. So just a very wonderful and very, very helpful analogy that I will credit you for when I use it in my own in my own world because it's great. It's really great.
Well, and it's interesting too, that thought came to me because I was engaging in the wholesome practice of getting exercise. And so I run 3 miles a day, and often I'll have inspirational images during that time. The endorphins are flowing, and as I was running today, that's the image that came. The concern, whenever we're talking about what possibly to do or what not to do, there's always the concern that people are going to concretize around that and think that is saying that something is right or wrong or good or bad, and that is not this is not what this is about. It's not about that as such, and it's also not about achieving in some kind of very linear way. So as I was running, thinking about this talk and how might I be careful not to give an impression that could be harmful for someone, that's when I had that image.
And then the other thing too that just occurred to me now is that's helpful about it is it's, you know, you're also interacting then with the environment, and that is variable, and so sometimes this effort of flying is happening in the context of a really clear, cool, calm, breezy thing.
Right.
Sometimes there's a tempest happening, or there's a really strong wind or a rain, and this effort is happening, and that the experience of flying mm-hmm. is going to vary depending on the winds of what's going on.
Yeah.
You know, we don't have any control over that, but we mm-hmm. can work with it.
Yes.
You know?
Yes. There's two other things that I found very helpful, just phrases, turning curses into gifts, which I think is particularly useful when you have some very difficult and strong difficulty in your life, and we have strong difficulties in our life, to think that it's possible to turn curses into gifts. Just that idea that we can turn that, no matter how terrible, it can be turned to help us awaken. Always. There's never a thing, just like nothing can be excluded. There's never going to be a thing that can't awaken us. Not that we want to bring bad things on for ourselves, but when they do occur. And the other is the way Pema Chodron talks about the grace of when you're doing Zazen and your mind goes away and you notice and you go, oh, come back to the breath. And then your mind goes away, oh, come back to the breath. That's an act of grace. Every time we drift away, every time we do something that is not what we were intending to do, and then we notice and we come back, that's an act of grace. I just found that just a wonderfully gentle teaching, you know, and that's a similar flavor to the bird here.
I don't know much about Dogen's life, but I love his writings. And apparently I'm not quite sure when someone asked him or how this came up, but he summarized his practice as, in Japanese, as shoshaku jushaku, which means one continuousness, one mistake after another, or one continuous mistake. Now, I'm not sure how all that came to be, but when I feel down, I remember that, and it helps me put things in perspective. That, as you say, my greatest mistakes, being divorced and then running into Joyce and then two depressions and then all and Hearst and everything that brought me out and how much more I've learned and become because of them
mm-hmm. yeah.
has really strengthened me in the practice and in my life.
Thank you. Well, may any merit that has come from the giving and receiving of this talk strengthen your resolve to awaken in this lifetime. Namah.